I think I like juxtaposing Parks and Rec as kind of the show of the first half of the decade and Veep as the show of the second half of the decade.
Happy New Year. The decade is over. And what did it all mean? Today, we look back at TV, theater, music, and film over the past 10 years.
It represents a shift that's taken place over the past decade where pop music is something that is taken seriously now.
What we saw over the decade is that Disney became a kind of unstoppable force, and we all live in Disney's world now.
Plus, actor Yahya Abdul-Mateen II closed out 2019 playing Dr. Manhattan in HBO's Watchmen. This year, he stars in high-profile films from Jordan Peele and Aaron Sorkin. And on top of all that, he's shooting the next Matrix movie. It's The Frame Weekend from the Mone Broadcast Center at KPCC. I'm John Horn. We'll be right back. Welcome to The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn, and Happy New Year. This is a show about entertainment, art, and culture, the people who make it, and what they're trying to say. A little later, we'll meet what's being touted as the first, but certainly one of the only LGBTQ mariachi groups. But we're going to start the show today with a series of conversations about the past decade in the world of culture.
Come on, what did De La Cruz always say?
Seize your moment.
Throw him off a building, right? Light him on fire, hit him with a blanket, right?
Yo, my man. They were asking me about the African-American experience. Maybe you could take this one.
Let's face it, Dad. You are not doing this for the sake of art. You are doing this because you want to feel relevant again.
I'm excited, and I feel relaxed, and I'm ready to party.
We're going to start with film. Joining me in studio are New York Times co-chief film critic Manola Dargis and culture critic Travel Anderson. Manola and Travel, welcome. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Very glad to be here.
So, in preparation for this conversation, we each made a list of the 10 films we thought really moved the needle culturally in the last decade. Not necessarily the best, maybe they are, but I'm curious to see what you guys brought in. I'm going to flip a coin. Heads, Manola, you're up first.
Thanks, John, for that. What I did is brought in my list that I made with my colleague A.O. Scott at the New York Times, and Tony and I did a list of our favorites, but we also did a list of what we felt were the most influential, for better or for worse.
Okay.
And, you know, I mean, I would say that right off the bat, the perfect example would be the 2012 movie The Avengers.
So, this all seems horrible.
I've seen worse.
Sorry.
No, we could use a little worse.
Stark, we got him.
Banner?
Just like you said.
Then tell him to suit up.
With this movie, suddenly we all had to take superhero movies differently. We had to kind of approach them differently. Mm-hmm. But it just felt like the weight of this movie seemed to augur something that was different. And what we saw over the decade is that Disney became a kind of unstoppable force. And we all live in Disney's world now.
We do. What else is on your list?
Well, influence, another would be, I think, The Hunger Games, which that may sound counterintuitive, but it was The Catching Fire, which came out in 2013. And that was actually an important movie in terms of gender representation for women. It became the first female-led movie to top the domestic box office in decades.
I volunteer as tribute.
I believe we have a volunteer.
She was a kind of female superhero in a mm-hmm. way, because you can think of Katniss Everdeen in that respect. That was actually something important. I think this decade has been very interesting in terms of women and, you know, the American movie industry, obviously.
So, Travel, are mm-hmm. there any superhero movies on your most influential and important movies of the
last
decade?
There is one, and that would be Black Panther.
Okay.
I feel like, you know, sort of the conversation that you mentioned about the Avengers, Black Panther was like this amazing moment. It was the first kind of superhero movement that was fronted by a predominantly black cast. And it ended up being like a cultural moment, I feel, at least at minimum for, you know, black folks, if not for the broader culture. You had people dressing in daishikis and cultural garb to go to the movie theater.
Your father and I would talk about this day all the time.
He is with us. And it is your time to be king.
But it was really just an amazing moment to see Ryan Coogler, this independent filmmaker, get a chance to have a swing at, you know, the major studio system. And you saw with Black Panther how he kind of injected a lot of kind of sociocultural commentary into the story.
And it's important to note, too, that Wakanda, a fictional country, ended up on the United States free trade list. So
somehow.
It's become Fredonia. It's become a real thing, which is terrifying. What's next for you?
Next Trevelle? For me, the oldest film on my list is from 2011 in the independent space, and that's Pariah from Dee Rees. I think it's just a great example of a queer filmmaker whose debut really like set her on this path. And I think it also was demonstrative for a lot of other queer filmmakers coming up behind her for, you know, the ability to do some of this kind of authentic storytelling in an unapologetic way. And I think it really showed a generation of queer filmmakers that we see now coming up that you can do this and you can do it authentically, do it your own way, and still be able to kind of achieve this kind of mainstream success as well.
I'm going to put out a movie that not only won an Academy Award for Best Picture, but also meant a lot to me, and that is Barry Jenkins' Moonlight. I thought this was...
On our list as well,
on everybody's list. Yeah. If it's not on your list, then you have no credibility.
Then forget it.
And maybe this is our unifying theme. This is a movie that told me a story I didn't know, and it's personal to Barry, and it's personal to a lot of people about what it means to grow up around addiction and what it means for a young boy to struggle with sexual identity and what it means to have people in your life who love you unconditionally. Mm-hmm. And I can hear two bars of Nicholas Britell's score from this film and start crying. It's a movie that I found beautiful and touching and hopeful. And there's so few movies that do all of those things.
But without the usual kind of like... You'd wrap a little happy bow on the package and make it everyone can feel nicely reassured and like smile. But, you know, I feel it's a very honest movie.
Yeah, too. It's a movie that I've literally watched entirely too many times and I cry every single time because it's a story that I do know and that, you know, it does reflect different parts of my own lived experience. But the way it was done, written by Terrell Alvin McCraney, Barry Jenkins, and then we can't forget the big envelope gate situation at the Oscars that year.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
Where La La Land was Best Picture for about 30 seconds?
Yes. Yeah.
This is not a joke. I'm afraid they read the wrong thing.
Moonlight, Best Picture.
And I think that even, you know, further cements it for its kind of influentialness.
Thank you.
Very clearly, even in my dreams, this could not be true. But to hell with dreams. I'm done with it because this is true. Oh, my goodness.
We're talking with Manola Dargis and Trevelle Anderson about movies from the past decade. I want to ask you about streaming, because that is a huge part of the conversation over what has happened in Hollywood over the past decade. And I'm going to start with a story that Nicole Holofcener told me about her film, The Land of Steady Habits. She has made all of her other movies theatrically. This was a Netflix movie. And after its first weekend on Netflix, somebody from the streaming service told her, more people watched this movie over the weekend than everybody who saw all of your movies combined in theaters.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Total.
I have one quick question. Did they watch it all the way through?
Well, okay. That's a different question.
No, because Netflix people should know does not release the numbers about how many people are actually watching things. But then there's also something called the completion rate.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, and that means, did they turn Roma on and turn it off 5 minutes later?
Yeah.
You know, that's a real important.
Trevelle, what about this whole evolution and how it's affected the kinds of movies that are getting made and seen?
I mean, I love this question because one of the films on my list I actually don't like. But I put it there because I do think that it fits into this kind of Netflix conversation. And it's Roma, as you mentioned earlier. I think it was a film.
Wait, you didn't like Roma?
I did not like Roma. I know I'm one of like.
Ladies and gentlemen,
five people.
The one person who I know.
I know.
And God bless you.
I know, but it's.
And
it's
you
just,
liked Cats, which is weird.
Roma's just not a movie for me. But I'm not sure if we would see a movie like that if Netflix did not provide the money, the space to allow Alfonso to do whatever he wanted.
And quickly, we're going to do a speed round. It doesn't have to be influential. It doesn't have to be best. Like 10 movies that are on your list. I'm going to start with Travel.
Decades?
What's on your list? Yeah.
Decades. So my list, my full list, it's Moonlight, Una Mujer Fantastica, Tangerine, Parasite, Black Panther, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, Girls Trip, Get Out, Roma, 13th, and Pariah, which is actually 11, not 10, because I don't follow rules.
Okay, I'm going to pick favorites because really, I don't need to mention Avengers again.
We know that Roma was not a favorite.
Roma actually was a favorite. It's not on my top. But The Assassin by Ho Chao Shen, Boyhood, Richard Linklater, Faces Places, Agnes Varda, In Jackson Heights, Frederick Weissman. All my directors are over the age of 60, I think. Luminous Intimacy, the cinema of Nathaniel Dorsky and Jerome Hiller. This was actually a really wonderful avant-garde program. I just shoved it on because no one could make me take it off. Mad Max, Fury Road by George Miller. No Home Movie by Chantel Ackerman. Poetry by Lee Chang Dong. 13th by Ava DuVernay, who we've mentioned before. And A Touch of Sin by the great Chinese director Zhao Zhongku.
My list, Interstellar by Christopher Nolan, Under the Skin by Jonathan Glazer, Tony Erdman by Maren Ade, Lady Bird, Greta Gerwig, Encendies by Denis Villeneuve, Moonlight, Barry Jenkins, Shape of Water, Guillermo del Toro, Fire at Sea, Gianfranco Rossi, and OJ, Made in America, Ezra Edelman.
These are all great movies. Super great lists,
yes,
you guys.
Yes, they are.
Travel and Manola, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was New York Times film critic Manola Dargis and culture writer Travel Anderson. You can find both of them on Twitter. This is The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. On this first weekend of 2020, we're taking stock of where we've been in the past decade in culture. We're going to turn now to Broadway.
Know your name? What's your name, man?
Alexander Hamilton. My name is Alexander Hamilton.
Lin-Manuel Miranda's Hamilton was certainly the biggest Broadway phenomenon of the last decade, and its influence is felt in many ways, like in the astronomical ticket prices for Broadway shows these days. Here's New York Times co-chief theater critic Jesse Green.
Despite these ridiculous numbers for certain shows, the profitability of those shows that are successful is only increasing. I had a look just today at the difference in the amount of money that was made on Broadway 10 years ago at the beginning of this decade and this year at the end of this decade. And the increase in attendance is a healthy 20%, but the increase in the price of tickets sold is 70%. So there, you know, what seems awful to us and to somebody who really, really wants to see Hamilton and doesn't have the money does not seem very awful to the people who are producing those shows and run the theaters. On the other hand, you do have to ask, eventually, isn't it going to squeeze out even the tourist dollar? Because what tourist is coming to New York with an extra $1,000 for their family to throw on even the best show on Broadway?
Does it create a difficult predicament for producers in that what they think may or may not work on Broadway becomes almost a litmus test on what they're going to invest in, meaning that there's almost some self-censorship before you get to Broadway about what is and is not a Broadway show? And does that start to limit the kind of range of artistic choices that you have as a critic or ticket buyers have as audience members?
You would think it would. And to some extent, that certainly happens, especially in the category of musicals, where the investments are between three and five times as much as for a play. It just, they're so costly. But working in the other direction, what I've noticed looking at the last year, couple years, and certainly over the last decade, is the rise of serious plays, which that model wouldn't really predict. But it's kind of like the Gap versus Banana Republic or something like that. It's an entirely different price point and different economy. So we've gotten some really astonishingly fine and serious plays that you wouldn't think, and certainly 10 years ago you would never have dreamt would come to Broadway, that have come to Broadway. They may or may not have made money, but their producers seem to have something else in mind, whether that's the social value of bringing these shows to Broadway or whether they plan to make money off of them in the aftermarket by being able to say fresh from Broadway.
We're talking with Jesse Green of the New York Times about the year on Broadway and in theater. What would you put in that category this past year of plays, original works that really knocked your critical socks off?
Certainly the play called Slave Play, which had been done off Broadway in a 200 seat theater to great acclaim. And when it was announced that it was moving to Broadway, this is a play by Jeremy O. Harris that basically looks at the problem of interracial relationships in three couples, but also the problem of the interracial relationships in America as a whole. And it's very subversive and shocking and overtly sexual and not the kind of thing you would have expected ever to move to Broadway, but it did. It's not clear to me that it will make money, but the producers want something else out of it, whether it's developing the talent of the playwright or whether they're going to do something with it in the future. Another one like that is a play called What the Constitution Means to Me, which was, again, at the same small theater off Broadway. No one ever thought it would come to Broadway. It did. It got critical raves and now is touring the country.
When you think over the past year and maybe even the past decade, how would you assess the evolution of representation when it comes to storytelling, hiring, casting, both playwrights, directors, and actors we see on stage?
It's definitely improving. I think most people would say it's not yet where it should be, although perhaps better than it is in the movies. One of the positive trends is not just that there's more what we call colorblind casting, where somebody could be cast in a role regardless of what the role was traditionally assumed to be in terms of race, for instance, but also more material representing different communities so that Black actors are sometimes playing Black characters instead of playing characters that have traditionally been white. So they can actually bring their life experience to the role. And as more of that happens more successfully, I think you're going to finally see equity in the coming years. But it's going to take another 10 years at least. And that's only for, you know, diversity of certain types. The newer kinds of diversity we're looking at, for instance, in terms of body ability, we have our first Tony Award winning person who uses a wheelchair this year. There's still not very much representation of people like her on Broadway or anywhere else. And of course, communities of color like Asians and Native Americans and all kinds of other groups are barely represented even now.
What do you see the questions that theater is asking, playwrights and musicals? Obviously, there are a lot of shows that aren't asking much. They're just trying to entertain. But when you start thinking about the kinds of questions that playwrights and book writers and lyricists are posing, do you start to think about common themes and common areas of exploration?
I'm not sure about common themes, but common approaches are beginning to become apparent. I had a look at what were the biggest hits on Broadway in the previous 10 years before this decade that's ending. Shows like Wicked and Hairspray and Book of Mormon, which were basically one way or another kind of traditional book musicals, usually musical comedies. And in the last 10 years, instead, the biggest hits like Hamilton, for instance, I'm leaving aside Disney for the moment, but musicals like Hamilton and Dear Evan Hansen, which together have already made $1 billion, are darker, more serious. They're more like the non-musical works that have been showing up on Broadway and that seem to be asking, as you suggested, a different kind of question, which is how are we going to live in our world today? Not, you know, what was cute about our world 30 years ago or 50 years ago.
Jesse Green is the co-chief theater critic for the New York Times. Jesse, always fantastic to have you on the show.
Thanks so much, John.
Coming up, from Call Me Maybe to Lizzo, a decade of pop music. That's next on The Frame Weekend. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. This past decade in pop music saw huge releases from Beyoncé, Adele, Kendrick Lamar, Taylor Swift, and Childish Gambino. But Nate Sloan and Charlie Harding, the hosts of the podcast Switched on Pop, say one of the most important tunes of the past decade was this 2011 hit from Carly Rae Jepsen.
It represents a shift that not only in our own listening, but a shift that's taken place over the past decade where pop music is something that is taken seriously now. Mainstream outlets, music critics, listeners on Twitter and other music podcasts like the one we host talk and analyze and break down with a lot of integrity the music of pop, which I think for a long time was considered kind of frivolous and not worth looking at too closely.
One of the things that happened in the past decade is the way that people listen to music changed fundamentally, and that was with the advent of streaming services.
Right.
So from the artist perspective and the songwriting perspective, is there a chicken and egg where songwriters and musicians started composing differently given the way that people were receiving and listening to music?
With streaming, there's a different set of economic incentives that are influencing how a composer or songwriter is thinking about what they're making in the studio. On Spotify and other streaming services, you only get paid per song, not by album. You also only get paid if someone listens to at least 30 seconds. And so we've seen a slight trend of some songs getting shorter, as well as albums getting longer, because if you're going to have one album pack it full of songs that people listen all the way through, better to get paid for 25 songs instead of only 7. And we've also seen, in order to hook people in, a lot of choruses are actually being put right up front to the beginning of the song. By the way, we don't think any of this is a bad thing. Every era has these slight changes. Songs are still great. There's so much good music being made, but it is changing the way that they're being written.
What you're saying is that you have to have a hook early because you're going to lose that audience if you don't catch them.
One of the masters of this new streaming economy is Drake, and you can hear this in a track of his like God's Plan, which doesn't start with a verse but starts with a little preview of a section much later in the song. It's almost like a little like a trailer for the song.
She say, do you love me? I tell her only partly. I only love my bed and my mom. I'm sorry. 50 dub, I even got it tatted on me. 81, they'll bring the crashers to the party.
So something else happens in this decade, and that is hip-hop becomes pop.
Right.
And that changes everything. How does that happen, and what is driving that?
It's been a change a long time in the making. I mean, we were talking about We discuss Outkast and Hey Ya in our first chapter, and we found this quotation from Andre Benjamin, who said he was very nervous to release that song because the idea of a singing rapper back in 2003 was kind of petrifying for him. If we fast forward to 2018, 2019, that fear would, I think, be out the window. I think the merging of hip-hop and song has become really a core part of the sound of pop music, thanks to artists like Kanye West and Drake.
We're talking with Charlie Harding and Nate Sloan about their book, Switched on Pop, How Popular Music Works and Why It Matters. I'm going to play a song that you have a chapter about by Luis Fonsi featuring Daddy Yankee, Despacito.
Fonsi! Ya me está gustando más de lo normal. Todo mi sentido va pidiendo más. Esto hay que tomarlo sin ningún apuro. Despacito, quiero respirar tu cuello despacito.
So what is behind a song like Despacito?
Yeah, there's so much to unpack in this modern masterpiece. One is the song merges old and new elements. You have this kind of classic traditional Puerto Rican cuatro guitar, but you also have these very modern programmed drums. You have the characteristic reggaeton rhythm. It marries the kind of smooth romantic vocals of Luis Fonsi with the rat-a-tat, almost rap-like delivery of Daddy Yankee. I think this is a song, no matter what you're looking for in a pop track, this will have it for you.
And it's probably not that big a leap to understand the popularity of Despacito to go see a lot of people at the Rose Bowl who don't speak a word of Korean singing along with every song that a K-pop band like BTS will perform. They don't understand the words, but it doesn't matter.
K-pop has been one of the biggest and most important phenomena, especially in the second half of this decade. And groups like BTS and Blackpink and Monsta X have amassed huge international fan bases. And many of those listeners may not speak Korean, but they voraciously learn about the lyrics and the stories behind the songs online.
Beach on me,
There are actually whole translating teams that work to make sure that this is approachable for everybody. And this music is phenomenal. It's really reinvigorated the idol style group, you know, the sort of boy band, girl group sort of style of music that was popular in the 90s in the United States. It's now back with a huge global audience.
When you look at the nominations for this year's Grammys and about what they say about maybe what musicians are doing, how they represent a snapshot of where music is, what is your take on what this says about where we are right now musically?
Yeah, it's sort of the opposite about what we were thinking about in terms of the influence of streaming, where maybe there are some trends that people are unifying around. I actually think when we look at the record of the year, we see divergence, where there is a lot of genre diversity, a lot of artists who are intentionally borrowing from many genres, perhaps even within one song. I think one of our favorite artists on the list would be Lizzo, mm-hmm. and her entire album.
The song Truth Hurts is up for record of the year.
That's right, yeah, and it's a fabulous song, which is hip-hop, it is pop, it borrows a reggae sample. Mm-hmm. There are many genres within just one song, and she has no problem bending her genre to meet the message of what she needs to accomplish.
I just took a DNA test, turns out I'm 100% that bitch, even when I'm crying crazy, yeah, I got...
Charlie and Nate, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, this has been really fun.
It's been a pleasure.
You could have had a bad bitch, not committal.
Nate Sloan and Charlie Harding host the podcast Switched on Pop. Their book, Switched on Pop, How Popular Culture Works and Why It Matters, is out now.
Why are men great till they gotta be great? Don't text me, tell it straight to my face. Best friend set me down in the salon chair. Shampoo press get you out of my hair.
On this episode of The Frame Weekend, we're looking at pop culture of the past decade. Up now, television. And joining me are two of my favorite regular guests, Lorraine Ali, the TV critic for the LA Times, and Daniel Feinberg, a TV critic at The Hollywood Reporter. So Daniel and Lorraine, I'm going to start with a personal story. I was a film reporter pretty much my whole life before I came to KPCC in 2014. And one of the first things I watched was the good season of True Detective. And I watched it and I said to everybody I knew, man, there's really good TV. I have not been watching it. This is as good as any movie that I have seen in the last year. And it was, I guess I arrived at the right time, but it was eye-opening to me because TV was not part of my life. And then it became part of my life. And that was literally the first series I watched in the new job.
I mean, I would say that probably you arrived then, say, 5 or 6 years behind the curve, in which everyone else was saying, oh, there's all this great stuff on TV.
Better late than never.
Poor John.
No, I think that the transition to the, oh my God, there's all this good stuff on TV, happened a decade earlier. You kind of look at what the 90s looked like, and it was still this world in which network TV was relevant in the critical and awards conversation, and then suddenly cable took over. But you get to this decade, and thanks to streaming and thanks to proliferation of cable, it becomes a point at which there's not even a conversation anymore, and where the movie people are even trying desperately to get in on the television access.
Right, and you saw that really at the beginning of the decade with House of Cards, right? When Kevin Spacey was doing a television show, it's like, wow, you know, he's moving that way. And I think it was the beginning of many things. I mean, you know, binging as a model for watching TV, right? And it was Netflix really breaking through at the forefront of really good original content. And then it was also these really, really kind of original narratives. You know, House of Cards, yes, but Orange is the New Black. Really, there was no real big stars. They were, you know, female narratives. It was made by a woman. And these were like characters that would have been marginalized in any show before that.
This is
Piper.
Chapman.
Look at you, Blondie. What'd you do? Aren't you not supposed to ask that question? I read that you're not supposed to ask that.
You read that? Well, you studied for prison?
I don't think with it, there's any question that Orange is the New Black is this incredibly crucial text, because we can still talk about it. Because the thing about House of Cards is, even before it became a thing you didn't want to touch because of Kevin Spacey, it also transitioned from being this ambitious, interesting political show to being this kind of crummy soap opera that we kept watching year and year anyway. Whereas Orange is the New Black opened doors. And I think giving all of those voices value is of so much more importance than whatever it was that House of Cards did, which was basically saying, if we give Kevin Spacey and David Fincher enough money, they will come do TV, which is a valuable lesson. There's no question about that, but it's a financial lesson. It's not an artistic lesson. The other defining show is, for better or for worse, the one we can't discuss, and that's the one created by Louis C.K. And Louis C.K. has, entirely through his own horrible actions, made it impossible to discuss him. And I am fine with that, and I understand it. But it still is important to recognize Louis as a TV show on FX and its importance. Without that show, you do not get Atlanta. You do not get Better Things. You do not get this entire list of idiosyncratic, small batch shows that are kind of the best of what the decade can do. So absolutely, let's condemn Louis C.K. to the skies, but let's also still acknowledge that there's a piece he plays in a bigger picture, which was a better picture.
That gets to this idea, too, that there are these singular voices that are telling original stories. And Lorraine, one of your top shows is The Good Place by Mike Schur.
Every single thing you did had an effect that rippled out over time and ultimately created some amount of good or bad. You know how some people pull into the breakdown lane when there's traffic and they think to themselves, ah, who cares? No one's watching. We were watching. Surprise!
A show that is addressing some really important things, philosophy and kindness and how we treat each other, that on a network seems almost unimaginable.
They make it so interesting and they make it really funny. And it's dealing also with the idea of like right and wrong and all that gray area in between. And my God, in this decade, like that idea of what's right, what's wrong, what's the truth, that certainly played into a lot of the struggles we were having on other fronts, you know, this decade, dealing with this presidency, dealing with politics, dealing with different forms of media coming at you. I think it sort of filled all that space in between and also asked the big question, is there really a good or bad place after this place?
We're talking with Lorraine Ali and Daniel Feinberg about the decade in television. Some of the best political commentary anywhere right now, I think, is on shows like John Oliver, Stephen Colbert, Trevor Noah. But in terms of scripted series, in terms of the way that fictional shows are dealing with the real world, do you guys see an evolution in thinking and a creative way for these shows to start talking about important issues, even through made-up stories?
I think I like juxtaposing Parks and Rec as kind of the show of the first half of the decade and Veep as the show of the second half of the decade.
I would like to be president someday, so no, I've not smoked marijuana. I ate a brownie once at a party in college. It was intense. It's kind of indescribable, actually. I felt like I was floating. Turns out there wasn't any pot in the brownie. It was just an insanely good brownie.
I kind of view Mike Schur as being our generation's Frank Capra. He is fundamentally an optimist. He believes that institutions work and that people, given the opportunity, will gravitate towards their better selves, which is kind of what The Good Place is about. Whereas you had Veep. And Armando Iannucci is not an optimist in the same way. He believes that there is a certain inherent rot in systems and in political institutions. And so if the first half of the decade was Leslie Knope trying to get things done in small town Indiana, and the second half was Selina Meyer basically becoming increasingly amoral in her desire simply to be the president of the United States, this is kind of the journey that we took over this decade.
As far as I'm concerned, America owes me an 8-year stay in the White House, and this time I want a war.
Yes.
But the amazing thing about Veep, I think, and Julie Louis-Dreyfus has said this, is that even though it is satire, what was happening in that show was not at all that far removed from what was happening in real life. The stuff they were making up was almost happening in reality.
Yes, and it was a comedy, which was also really sad because it was reflecting what was going on almost in real time. But you also had that with The Handmaid's Tale. Those first two seasons were chilling. And I think it was reflecting, you know, our deepest fears about, you know, what's going to happen moving forward, about what was happening at the time in that first season. The second season, though, showed you how they got there. And that was what was so terrifying.
I think on an absolute scale, in terms of representation, TV is not doing well relative to film, maybe doing a little bit better. But where have we seen the most material changes in front of and behind the camera? And not just in terms of the ethnicity of the performers, age, disability, sexual orientation, gender.
Well, I would look at Insecure, obviously, as a show that embodied so much of that.
Is this what you always want to do?
No, but I got this job after college and it fit my interest at the time.
Are you single?
I don't think that's appropriate.
Yes, you're single.
All women, women of color, bringing you into parts of L.A. that are not white L.A., are not the rich West Side. And then you look at something like Master of None or Rami.
You don't even have a real job.
What?
You do nothing at a startup that does nothing.
Habibti, they are starting up. Give them a chance.
Thank you, Mom.
First, second generation, kids of immigrants, but showing you this immigrant, this slice of immigrant culture that you didn't see on TV before. They weren't the guys with the funny accents or their sidekicks. They're like the kids growing up here that are having problems dating, that have career issues. Then, you know, women, God forbid, over 40, you know, in shows like Big Little Lies or Better Things. So across the board, you're seeing this sort of show like Atypical, you know, about an autistic kid and how a family deals with that on Netflix. I would say this decade was really when, I hate just saying diversity exploded. It's just like when things opened
up.
Yeah, people woke up. Things opened up. And the idea that, you know, diversity is good for you. No. It's better. It's more interesting. It makes better TV.
And even more than that, and I think this is something TV has done spectacularly well, it's obtainable.
Lorraine Ali is the TV critic at the LA Times. Daniel Feinberg is a TV critic at The Hollywood Reporter. Lorraine and Daniel, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Coming up on The Frame Weekend, in 2020, Yahya Abdul-Mateen II will star in two high-profile films. This after closing out 2019 as Dr. Manhattan in HBO's hit miniseries Watchmen. Stay with us. This is The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. Yahya Abdul-Mateen II ended 2019 with a huge role on one of the year's most talked about shows. He played Dr. Manhattan, sorry if that's a spoiler, in HBO's Watchmen. In 2020, he'll star in two high-profile movies, Jordan Peele's Candyman and Aaron Sorkin's The Trial of the Chicago 7. In that latter film, he'll play Bobby Seale, the co-founder of the Black Panther Party. That's a lot of success for a guy who started off the last decade as an architect fresh out of UC Berkeley, where he looked at acting as more of an outlet than a possible career.
Acting was really a rejection of architecture. And my architecture experience at Berkeley, it was a very good experience, but I found acting when I needed something different.
I want to ask you about Watchmen.
Yeah.
One of the things that's challenging, I would assume, about this part, and this is no longer secret, is that you're playing a character who has abilities beyond understanding.
Mm-hmm.
He is transcendent.
The way I experience time is unique, and for you particularly infuriating. That said, I am simultaneously in this bar having a conversation with you and on Europa creating life.
Yeah. And how does one create life?
I do it with the wave of my hand.
When you're thinking about what you're going to embody about Dr. Manhattan and about how he is this godly character, but he's also filled with knowledge and kindness, how do you start to figure out how to embody that?
Man, that's an excellent, excellent question. My impulse was to go to neutral, but neutral was boring. Neutral was very, very boring. And then also, I knew that the challenge was if I'm too godlike, then I am not relatable, and if I'm too much like a human, then I'm not special. You know, then he's not a god. So I really had to slow down my process and to say, well, you're a quote unquote god who wants to be a human. And what eventually happened was I can only find that in my scene partner.
This is Regina King's character.
Yeah. I love you.
We just met. When did you fall in love with me?
I was already in love with you.
Before you even saw me?
I don't experience the concept of before.
So, there's no moment?
Moment?
A moment when you realize I'm in love.
And I was very happy when I saw it. I said, oh, wow, okay, there's a really good balance.
Watchmen is so much about justice and the way that we look at people, and particularly the way we look at people with black skin and brown skin. Mm-hmm. And you're doing another project, The Trial of the Chicago Seven, where Bobby Seale is tried and treated as if he's not a member of the real world. Mm-hmm. And he is put in prison for contempt of court. So even if Aaron Sorkin's movie is about the trial, I suspect that's not what it's really about.
It's about freedom. It's about freedom of speech. It's about being active and seeing something and putting yourself on the line. It's about not being passive. Unfortunately, you know, I believe the film will resonate in 2020, you know, when I think right now, definitely as Americans, even in the world, I think we have so many comforts that keep us from really speaking out to against a lot of the injustices in the world. And it's definitely, the movie is definitely saying, hey, if you see something wrong, then we got to get out. Sometimes you got to take it to the streets. You got to put your comforts on the line.
We're talking with Yahya Abdul-Mateen II. I'm going to ask you about some other projects.
Sure.
Okay, so I remember a couple years ago talking with Lakeith Stanfield about Get Out, and he told me being on the set of that film was super creepy.
Wow.
As creepy as it was to watch the film, it was just as creepy to be on set.
Wow.
Is the same thing true for an actor in Candyman?
I wouldn't say creepy. I wouldn't say creepy. I could definitely see that being the case in Get Out. I could definitely see Get Out being a creepy atmosphere. Candyman was sneaky, and it catches you off guard. You know, you say, oh, this is not just about the jump scares, and also, you know, this is not just about I'll say the subject matter that we're presenting on the surface. You know, there were several days where I left home toward the end of the shoot, and I said, oh, that's why this movie is important.
When you are as busy as you are and people want to hire you, you're doing a Matrix movie, you've got the Jordan Peele thing, Aaron Sorkin, Watchmen. How do you step back and make sure you have perspective on the choices you're making and that they fit in, not just in terms of like, I want to do some action movie, but that you are doing things that are meaningful to you in the long run?
I recently switched over to a new agency. One of the first things that I told them, I said, hey, man, I really like my career thus far, but if I take all of my projects in my hand and I throw them out on the table, I said, it doesn't really say anything. It says that I'm a versatile actor and that I can book jobs. If I stop there, I think that's success as an actor. If I look myself in the mirror and I say, well, how do I want to be remembered, or what is my cause, and say that I want my work to represent something larger than myself, then that's when I have to say, okay, well, now we have to be more strategic and say, well, what do we want to do next? And that's sort of where I am right now. And it's an interesting negotiation, because I kind of want to have it all, honestly. I want to be able to just say, you know what, I just want to go and be a clown this week, and I just want to go have fun. And that's not about anything but expressing freedom and putting joy and laughter out into the world. And at the same time, I want to be able to do that and then to go pick up something like The Trial of the Chicago Seven and talk about a different type of freedom, talk about the freedom that we fight for.
Yahya, thanks so much for coming on the show.
It's been definitely a pleasure. I appreciate you.
Go Bears.
Yeah, go Bears. There we go.
Yahya Abdul-Mateen II is an actor. He was in Watchmen. Later this year, he stars in Candyman and The Trial of the Chicago Seven. It's The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. We're going to close out today with a story about a band who claimed to be the first LGBTQ mariachi group. Frame contributor Marcos Najara has the story.
You know it's Christmas when you hear Mi Burrito Sabanero. The classic Latin American carol tells the story of a child's journey of faith. There are countless versions, like the 70s original, to this more modern take by Guatemala's Gaby Moreno. Even neo soul man Alo Black. But nobody does it quite like Mariachi Arcoiris de Los Angeles. El lucerito mañanero ilumina mi sendero. El lucerito mañanero ilumina mi sendero. Si me ven, si me ven, voy camino de Belén. That's because this is arguably the world's first out and proud mariachi troupe.
Because we're arcoiris, we're special.
And its star is Natalia Mari Meléndez.
She's feeling diva-ish.
She's equal parts musician and history maker. The troupe promotes the violinist as the first transgender woman in mariachi.
I didn't know I would be like a spokesperson for our community. I try to set the standard really, really high.
But out in Pico Rivera recently, this rising star faced much more mundane problems.
I'm a girl, I like my nails.
During a late night run through of Burrito Sabanero, her manicure melted down.
These ones here, see what I do is I get my nails done, but my left hand, because it's my fingering hand, they're all cut short, but my thumb. On my right hand, I have all looking long and pretty. But they're falling apart. Don't clown me.
I wasn't clowning. I was like,
out, honey. Read, girl, read.
You can tell Meléndez and her fellow musicians have formed a little family over the years.
We communicate through an app. It's our own personal mariachi app. Girl, that library stays open 24/7.
There's lots of laughter and lighthearted teasing at rehearsals and shows. It's a rare sense of camaraderie and good cheer the troupe tries to offer fans.
That is exactly what we give the LGBTQ plus community. LGBTQ plus ABCDEFG. They just keep adding and adding and adding, girl. It's the whole alphabet. Okay, on a serious note, we want to engage you. Because when you go hear mariachi, regular mariachi, like, you hear the man sing, and then he's singing all that pain to his woman or whatever. But what if there is a gay man that is feeling that pain? You want to feel that, too. You really do. Me, as a trans woman, I always wanted a man to sing to me. Acaba de una vez. And I wanted him to mean it. De un solo golpe. And that's what Arcoiris does, you know. Men sing to men, the lesbian will sing to another woman. That's our niche.
Meléndez fell in love with the violin at 8 years old while growing up in LA's El Sereno neighborhood.
Those were some good years for me, honey.
But family strife and deep depression crept in by the time the young gay boy became a teen. And soon, he left L.A. for a year to live in a Christian retreat.
I just prayed about it because I was like, I was at my wit's end because I was trying to numb who I really was. Ask God, I'm here, I surrender. If I'm to be a man and be with a woman, put it in my heart and let me know. Or the woman that I feel I am, and obviously that's what he gave me. So I left over there and I came back to Los Angeles, trailblazing.
Looking back, Meléndez wishes she had a trans woman role model to look up to. Ironically, had the internet been more reliable back in the late 90s, Meléndez might have learned about another trailblazer, Teresita La Campesina. La Campesina was a trans woman who performed mariachi and ranchera music in San Francisco's Mission District back in those days. UC Santa Cruz professor Marcia Ochoa remembers her well.
Everything stopped when she started singing, you know. It was just all about channeling that voice.
Ochoa says while Natalia and Teresita may have never met, she believes Teresita watches over Natalia as a trans ancestor.
As we say now, you and I, a transcestor.
A little bit more...
Back in L.A.,
crying.
Arco Iris' director, Carlos Samaniego, leads rehearsal with a bit of an iron fist.
Get the right phrasing. Ba, ba, da, ba, da, ba.
But these rigorous rehearsals have paid off. They are in constant demand.
I remember when we did our first same-sex wedding. I got the phone call, and it was one of the grooms, and he said, is this right? I can't believe it. He's like, I can't believe you guys exist. I'm like, Mariachi Arco Iris saving the day with mariachi at your gay wedding. And I think it's fabulous.
I'm Marcos Najera for The Frame.
And that is it for today. The Frame Weekend is edited by Darby Maloney and produced by Herb, Monica Bushman, Jonathan Shiflett, and Julia Paskin. Our engineers are Eduardo Perez and Alex Gonzalez. Andrea Gutierrez is our news clerk. The Frame's opening theme music is by Taylor McFerrin, and our senior producer is Oscar Garza. I'm John Horn at the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. We're back here on Monday with a daily version of The Frame. We'll see you then. Suplicándome que hoy vuelva contigo. Qué cinismo, qué ni vergüenza tienes.